DCT Audio. The art of good listening. This is a story, a true story, that most people won't be aware of, but yet is as remarkable an account you will ever hear of bravery, loyalty, and devotion to public service. On Wednesday, the 5th of January, 1983, minutes before his shift was due to end, Police Constable Pat Abram attended an incident that would nearly end his life and take the lives of three of his colleagues and that of a member of the public. All who perished drowned in the sea off Blackpool in conditions many described as the worst they had ever seen. In a rare interview, Pat Abram describes that day and the circumstances that led to that awful tragedy. This podcast is a tribute and memorial to those who perished. Mr. Alistair Anthony and Police Constables Angela Bradley, Gordon Connolly and Colin Morrison.
Pat Abram, a very warm welcome today. It is a genuine honour to have you here. And perhaps we'll just start with providing a bit of a context, really, I suppose. The sea's in your blood, isn't it? It's fair to say.
I grew up in Fleetwood. My father was a fisherman who was a trawler engineer, and sadly, he drowned at sea when my mother was 2 months pregnant with me. And I grew up in Fleetwood when it was a vibrant fishing port. Most of the town had got one or more of the families involved in the fishing industry, either going out to Iceland or locally as fishermen.
And I think you mentioned to me, didn't you, earlier, that you've actually witnessed some tragedies at sea as well.
That's right. I mean, when I was 8 or 9, a place in Fleetwood called the Ferry, near where the current lifeboat station is, a young girl, probably a similar age to me at the time, about 8 or 9, got into trouble. The beach drops away quite severely. She went into the water and got into difficulties in the fast-flowing estuary. I saw two men go in, attempt to rescue her. Fortunately, they were successful, but they had a struggle really to retain hold of her and get her out of the water. So it brought home to me, although it had been instilled into me, to be cautious of the water. And, you know, that stuck with me. It was a good childhood. I mean, on my father's side, obviously, I didn't know him because he obviously passed away before I was born. But I understand that some of these relatives were actually on the crew at the Fleetwood lifeboat. And because of the way my father had died, we've got quite a close association with my mother with the lifeboat. We used to go to the lifeboat open days. And the whole town really was supportive of the lifeboat, as it is in a lot of fishing towns and villages. And as a child, 9, 10, 11, when the Maroons used to launch, we all used to cycle down there to watch the boat be launched. So, yeah, quite closely associated with both the sea and the lifeboat.
And I should imagine there'll be quite a personal connection with that lifeboat at Fleetwood, because they were essentially going out to rescue people that were either friends or loved ones.
That's right, yeah. Very, very supportive. It was a vibrant fishing port, both deep sea trawlers going out to Iceland and local fishing industry. Most families had got one or more people involved in the fishing industry. So, you know, there was a lot of support for the lifeboat because, you know, they went out, risked their lives when menfolk were in danger or in trouble themselves.
Now, I know today you do a lot of work for the RNLI. It's still hard to believe that it's a charity and not a government-funded emergency service, if you will, with all the fabulous work they do. And we'll talk about your volunteering later. But what's a lad brought up in Fleetwood with the sea in his blood? What makes him join the police?
It was something I'd always intended to do, really, from a very young age. I saw a number of incidents in the town where the police dealt with people. It was a lively town in those days.
It still is.
It was something I'd set my mind on. And, you know, I left school at 16 and joined as a cadet straight from school. And that was always my ambition.
Obviously, in the early 80s, you would have been working at Blackpool. Just describe the shift that you were on.
You work together as a team. You work together and you socialise together. I remember an old sergeant saying, "We're very much like a family." And I think that's a fair description, really. Your life centred around work and socialising. And as I say, you both work together and you socialise together with partners, friends, etc. So you're very close as a team, and you work with the same people, the same shift for some time, really. I started at Blackpool in 75 when I was 19, which was the age when you were appointed as a constable then. I started initially at Bispham, and after a year or so went to work at Blackpool Central.
So by the time you're 22, a young man, you will have had quite a bit of life experience within the police, won't you? You'll have seen a lot by then.
Certainly, yeah.
Gordon, Colin and Angela, they were on your shift?
Angela and Gordon were on the shift. In those days, they call them panda cars. I believe they call them immediate response vehicles now. Colin was a traffic officer. He worked on traffic and covered predominantly the Blackpool area.
As people, how were they? How did you find them?
Gordon and Angela were sort of similar age. Angela was 23, Gordon 24, and I was 26 in 1983. So we were all keen police officers, and we always looked after each other. We were the three mobile vehicles covering the Blackpool central area, and we always looked after each other, watched each other's back, and supported the lads that were out on the beat as well. So we worked very, very closely together.
Now, as a former detective, as I am as well, we always say get straight to the heart of the matter. But it's important that I thought we should just cover a little bit of the backstory in context to what really we're essentially going to talk about. And that was the 5th of January, 1983, that awful day when Angela, Colin and Gordon lost their lives together with a member of the public and his dog. How did that day start for you?
Well, to be fair, if we sort of wheel back to Tuesday, the 4th of January, we were actually on a 2-10 shift. And to be honest, in the build up to the 2 or 3 days before, we'd had high tides, strong winds, and the sea defences on the Golden Mile, different to what they were now. And when it's high tides driven by the wind, quite often the water would come over onto the promenade, onto the tram tracks and onto the road then. And we'd had that certainly on the Tuesday, the 4th of January. So we knew, you know, we're experiencing high winds, strong tides, and you were always wary of that. Obviously, we finished at 10 o'clock on the Tuesday evening. We're back on at 6 a.m. on the Wednesday morning. And again, conditions were pretty much the same. The water was coming over again. So we knew that the sea conditions were quite severe. So about 2:15, I was parked in the main square in the centre of Blackpool.
It's Talbot Square.
Talbot Square,
it?
Yeah, opposite the North Pier. Really waiting to go in and end the shift. At 1:48, a radio message broadcast from the force headquarters over the local PR gave a report of a person in the sea near to what was the Pembroke Hotel.
Yeah, so that's going to be north of where you were.
North, yeah.
Parked up,
yeah. As soon as the call came in, I set off to go to the promenade a short distance out of the square. And as I reached the traffic lights, a traffic car travelling north along the promenade on blues and twos, went through the lights in front of me, and that was Colin Morrison. I turned to go north, and as we reached Cocker Square, Colin carried on along the upper promenade, but knowing the geographic sort of area, I went on to the middle walk.
It's kind of a tiered level.
It is. There's the promenade, a middle walk and a lower walk. But obviously, to get to the lower walk, I knew we'd have to go down one of the slides. So I went on the middle walk and was driving along when I was flagged down by an individual somewhere in the area around the Imperial Hotel. Stopped the panda car, had a brief conversation. I was told that the person in the water was being carried north, and at that time Gordon Connolly actually overtook me, and I saw him in a mirror that Angela was behind me. We were obviously all three of us in the town centre, very close together, and responded together. As I spoke to this chap, got back in the car, could see people towards Gin Square waving at us, so it was clear they were identifying that whatever the ongoing incident was towards Gin Square.
So this is about a mile probably from where you parked up initially,
wasn't it? So I arrived at Gin Square, and there's a slide leading down from, or a slope, should I say, leading down from the middle promenade to the lower promenade. So Gordon went down, I went down, and followed by Angela. And we stopped at the top of the slide that leads down to the beach. The seas were mountainous, to be fair. I think that's the only way to describe them. There was waves coming over the seawall. The slide was partly awash with water, and also breaking waves coming over the slide. All three of us went over the gate, which was across, which was locked, obviously, which they did at a high tide to prevent members of the public going. And at that time, I looked over the wall and saw this individual, Alistair Anthony, in at least one, if not two, life belts, really being taken along at walking pace. And it was clearly evident there that that was, in my mind, the last opportunity we had of getting hold of him. Because beyond there, it's a vertical seawall, probably a Victorian seawall, probably 25, 30 foot high, with an overhang at the top. And the sets of steps going down periodically.
Rescue would have been impossible
had he got past there. Just to go back a little, on the shift that I worked on, in the police, you had to have a permit for any type of vehicle. And I was the only person on the shift that had a permit to drive the police Land Rover. And at that time, the RLNI Inshore boat, the D-Class, was launched by the police Land Rover because the RLNI didn't have a Land Rover to launch it. So on occasions when the regular drivers weren't available, I would go and launch the Inshore boat. So I knew that the likelihood of that D-Class being launched, it was quite remote. I was quite confident in my own mind. It was beyond the limits from the experience I'd had with launching it.
And I suppose that was probably one of the first cruel twists of fate regarding this incident, wasn't it?
That's right, yes. Yes, so, you know, and I knew some of the crew and some of the shore staff. I knew the conditions were severe. We were presented with Alistair Anthony in the water, and it was either then or never, in my view. And I made the decision that I would go in after we'd gone over the gate, both me, Gordon and Angela. As I say, the slide was awash with water. Waves were breaking over, and they were also breaking over the top of the wall. So I put on a life belt, which was handed to me, put it round me, and basically the rope attached to the life belt was tied on. And it was actually tied on the landward side of the slide. So it had to span the width of the slide.
How wide would that have been?
It's wide enough to get an HGV down.
Right, to be fair. So 12 feet at least.
At least, yeah. That's one of the things it looked back on. Had we tied on the seaward side, things may have been different, but that wasn't to be. I then went in the water, down the slide, the sloping side of the slide. I mean, the water was breaking over you. And as I went to go down with that, lowering myself on the line, I slipped and went in. I mean, because the water was breaking over. And I initially went under, came up, and I got within about 6 feet of Alistair Anthony, stretched my arm out, and he put his out, and we couldn't connect. There was just that gap of about 6 feet. And I knew if I left the life belt, that would have been the end of me, really. So I made the decision. I'd come out and I used the rope to pull myself up the side of the slide in the water, as I say, with the waves breaking over you. Got back on the slide. The line was undone. And Gordon actually had a rolled up piece of line in his hand. I don't know where that came from, obviously. The rope that was attaching me was undone by Angela and or with the help of a member of the public that was there. All the time, he's moving the length of the slide. And I knew that if we were going to any chance of getting him out, I had to go in again before he passed the edge of the slide, because it would have been impossible had that happened. I was of the view, because I was constantly watching him, that the extended piece of rope had been attached.
So that piece of rope was tied to the original piece of rope that you had?
I was under the view that it was.
Yeah.
Whether it was or it wasn't. But the last thing before I'm watching him, the last thing, I saw Angela with a rope round her waist, holding on, going to support me and Gordon beyond her. And I went in again. And as I went in off the side of the slide further north, we're engulfed by a massive wave, and I went under, and when I came up, I had to get my bearings, basically. I looked around and I could see Alistair Anthony, who was in the life belt, or life belts that he was in, very close to the sea wall. And Gordon and Angela were either side of him, holding on to the belt he got. And they were being buffeted against the wall. I'd been taken further out. I'd still retained hold of the life belt that I was in, but obviously the rope wasn't attached any longer. We shouted to each other, albeit the sound of the sea, etc., shouted over to Gordon and Angela, "You okay?" And they responded. And then, again, engulfed, there was waves breaking over the top of you. One of the waves broke over me. I looked around. I saw this Dago jacket, which I sort of immediately recognised as a police officer's coat, the type of jacket that traffic officers wore in those days. It was further out. So I swam over with the belt round, and this individual was face down in the water. I got hold of him, and it was Colin Morrison. And he was clearly in a bad way at that stage. I don't know how Colin ended up in the water. I think, sort of looking back at the incident, his car was parked up on the roundabout on the main promenade. And I can only imagine that he came down, saw us on the slide and come to join us, and was probably washed off by the same massive wave that sort of engulfed us all and took Angela and Gordon into the water at the same time. I don't think it was ever clearly established, but that was the working hypothesis, really, of how Colin came to be in the water.
How old was Colin?
Colin was 38.
So he was a little bit older.
He was an older guy than us, and he was fully clothed. Of course, I'd taken my jacket off, got rid of my radio, etc., before I went in. Colin was, he got a tunic on, he got a Dayglow jacket, all his kit. As I got hold of him and pulled his head out of the water, he said, "We're done for here." And I said to him, "The insurer will be here shortly." That's the lifeboat, yeah, the insurer, as we called it. As I said,
I knew
it wasn't coming. So, yeah. He just said, "Keep me up." And I trapped his arms in the life belt, between my body and the life belt. Mm-hmm. We've been engulfed all the time, waves breaking over us. And every time a wave had broken over us, he was sort of struggling. A couple of times he was actually washed out of the belt, very close to me, and went down. I pulled him up at least twice, and I could see that he was deteriorating. I was then aware of another officer, by which time there was a number of officers, on the lower walk. I could see them.
How long would you have been in the water by now?
We went in. The call was
1348,
yeah. Colin Morrison booked off on the force radio at the scene at 13:50, 2 minutes after the call came over. We were probably there on the slide by then. It was very, very quick. So probably been in about 13:50, 13:52, and I was eventually pulled out at 14:15.
And let's not forget, it was cold that day as well.
It was cold. It was severely cold. The sea state was, as I say, I would describe it as mountainous. It was like a boiling cauldron, really. It really was. And at that stage, when I was supporting Colin, I realised we were in trouble. An officer threw a belt to us, Martin Hewitson, landed probably, I don't know, about 3 yards away, keeping hold of Colin with him trapped between the life belt and holding on to him. I got to the belt, got an arm through the belt, and it was like trying to pull a car with one arm. It just eventually, it pulled off my arm. I said to Colin, "I've lost the belt." And he didn't respond. His face went in the water again. I lifted his head out, and he was severely cyanosed. He'd foamed at the mouth and the nose, and he was red in the face. And I knew he'd gone. My intention was to keep hold of him in the vain thought that we could be rescued, but the current was carrying us along, going northwards towards an area called the Boating Pool. And again, young in service, I worked at Bispham, and I knew how treacherous it was from the Ging going north, particularly around the Boating Pool. And I ended up getting pulled in the corner towards the Boating Pool. And I had to make the decision because Colin actually floated behind me with his arms trapped in the belt, and I knew he was dead. And I made the decision I'd have to let him go because he was going to take me down with him.
I can't imagine how hard that must have been.
Yeah, very difficult, but I knew he was dead. I wouldn't have let him go if I hadn't. So, yes, decision hard to make, but obviously he was going to take me down with him, or potentially. And then I ended up in the corner near where the boating pool is, and it was like being in a washer. As I say, 25, 30-foot wall with an overhang to turn the waves back, and I was clinging onto the life belt because I knew if I lost the life belt, that was me finished. And I was being churned over. I was hitting the overhang on the top of the waves, and I was hitting the sand going under the water, and I was being churned. And I could feel everything getting distant. By this time, there was dozens of people, police officers, we'll call them fire and rescue now, firemen, then ambulance personnel. I could hear people shouting. I particularly, as I got churned up on one occasion, came back down, Brian Outram and John Churchman were shouting to hang on. And then eventually, as I say, everything was getting distant, and I knew I was going. I was trying my best to, with my legs to, because obviously I knew if my head hit the seawall, that would have made things even worse. My head did hit the seawall two or three occasions, and I knew I was going. There was belts and ropes being thrown all the time, and I couldn't get to them. And I knew I hadn't got the strength, even if I got hold of one of the belts, you know, such a high wall, I couldn't have held on to it then.
And at that point, I appreciate you had to let Colin go. Gordon and Angela, were you aware they were there?
No, I never. To be fair, the last time I saw them, I actually thought they possibly got out of the first set of steps. I mean, there's the slide, two sets of steps, then the boating pool. And the last I saw of them was when they were against the wall with Alistair Anthony in the life belts and one of Angela and Gordon on either side. And then we got engulfed and I didn't see them again. And I actually thought they'd probably got out at the steps, whereas I got taken further out with Colin. I then, as I'm being churned up, I became aware of something around my neck. And at the same time, there was a fireman throwing what looked like a harness down, which landed near to me. And I thought, if I can just get hold of that or get in it. But then I just felt this sensation of being choked. And really, the only other recollection I've got is my head hitting the overhang and then at some stage being wrapped in tinfoil, presumably a survival-type blanket. And that really is my last recollection till I woke up in intensive care. A day or so later.
Do you recall what was going through your mind when you came to in the hospital?
Well, I came to, I thought I was paralysed, although I didn't realise they'd given something for me to. I couldn't move anything but my eyes. And there was two colleagues, Norman Ellsby and Wilf Hartley, there when I woke up. And I asked about Angela and Gordon. And that's when I found out they'd gone.
I suppose a credit to them for them being honest with you, bearing in mind your own physical condition, to receive that awful news on your hospital bed. It's the worst news of all at any point in time and situation, but to be in intensive care and get that, I can see even now it hurts.
It does, yeah. And obviously I knew Colin had gone. I had a full recollection of all the events, you know, it was indelibly ingrained and still is. So, you know, I knew, and they were obviously keen, as was everybody in the police, from the chief constable down, to know exactly what had happened, and keen to get an account from me. And I respect them for being truthfully honest and telling me that Gordon and Andrew had gone.
So obviously you did give an account. Did you feel that you were given sufficient time just to come to terms with what had happened? I mean, appreciate, we know what police work is like. It's that initial account is very important, but you know, looking back now, did you think you were given that time to just process it all? And
I think it was necessary, to be fair, because hindsight is a great thing, and there was a lot of speculation that I learnt subsequently about what the circumstances were, why Alistair Anthony was in the water. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter why anybody's in the water, if a life is at risk.
Yes.
I think as a police officer or any member of the emergency services, you've a duty to try and save life. There was speculation, but of course, as you and me know, we took an oath when we joined as a police officer to protect life and property. And on that day, at that time, when we arrived at that Slade, I believe we could rescue Alistair Anthony. And the course of events that followed was as a result of that decision that I made in a split second that I would go in. And I needed to give an explanation to justify and possibly put to rest all the speculation of why the events had happened.
It's interesting you bring that up because of recent events, shall we say. How did you feel about the press coverage at the time regarding the incident?
Well, as we all know, the press, when an incident like that happens, wants to give an account. And subsequently, weeks and months later, I read a number of accounts, you know, on the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and there was all sorts of different accounts given.
And a lot of armchair critics,
I would you know.
Imagine.
That's right.
The word tragedy is used, isn't it? We sometimes don't understand the meaning of these words, but I don't think people realise just how incredibly close you were to rescuing Alistair Anthony.
I was 6 feet away from him. We had our outstretched hands and, you know, we were probably within about 4 foot. But I couldn't leave the belt. I'd have lost my life. You know, that's why I made the decision to come out and try and go in again and get him. Because once he was past the Slade, it was virtually impossible to reach him.
Once the news had sunk in, I'm talking more about the town itself now and the people and Fleetwood as well, because everybody would have known you in Fleetwood. What was the mood of the community?
There was an outpouring of, you know, sorrow for the loss of life and also a lot of support in the town. I mean, the mayor launched an appeal to support the families of those that had lost their lives. Mm. Colin was married with 4 young children. Gordon Connolly had only recently got married, and ironically, about a week after, his wife found out that she was pregnant with her first child. Obviously, Angela, she was single, but her parents and a younger sister, Dawn, who was only 17 at the time, it was a tragedy.
And people don't realise, do they, unless you've been part of a tragedy, just how it ripples out. The impact.
It does. When I came out of hospital the first time, a friend of mine said, do you want to go for some lunch? And I said, no, I actually want to go to the baths at Fleetwood, get in the water, and then get in the sea. Because as I laid in hospital, I thought, I really do need to go back in the water. It's very much like when you've fallen off a bike, you should get back on it. That's what I did. And that was, as I laid in the hospital bed, I thought, I need to get back in the water just to get my confidence back.
A lot of people that are involved in incidents or multiple deaths, the survivors have what's called survivor guilt. Why me? Why did I survive? Or it should have been me that lost a life. Did any thoughts enter your mind?
It did. I have the image ingrained of the events, but particularly as I went to go in the second time, Angela on the Slade with a rope from the belt that was supporting me wrapped around her waist, looking to feed me out. And, you know, the water was breaking over her legs. She was waist deep or thereabouts. And just knowing that she was there and Gordon was behind her as well, supporting me. And just knowing that it was a team effort, but they ended up in the water. I'd made the decision to go in. They went in involuntary because they were washed off by the wave. So, yeah, I do dwell on that. It's been the 5th of January this year, 2023, was the 50th anniversary. Yeah. And, you know, I think about it virtually every day and I do relive it. But I think everybody did the best they could. Circumstances were such that We didn't achieve what we were trying to do, but we did come very close.
Has it given you any problems over the years with your own well-being and mental health?
Not really. I mean, ironically, I spent a period in hospital, went to the police convalescent home at Harrogate for 3 weeks, and on the last day, we went out for a Chinese. Mm-hmm. And on the Friday, when I was going to get picked up from the convalescent home, I felt terrible, and I thought it was the Chinese. What it was the onset of infectious hepatitis from absorbing the seawater, which wasn't the cleanest at the time. And I ended up back in hospital for 4 weeks, suffering from infectious hepatitis.
So the sea hadn't finished with you just yet?
That, together with the neck injury, has sort of has affected me. And I have one or two medical problems that I won't dwell upon, which are a consequence of of ingestion of water, basically. But I'm here today. I'm here telling you or giving you an account of what happened. Unfortunately, Angela, Gordon and Colin aren't. And the real reason that I wanted to give an account, and I've only ever done it once before, is because we're all getting older. Came home to me on the 40th anniversary, January 5th, just passed, that, you know, we're not getting any younger. And I just want to ensure that the memory of Angela Gordon and Colin and Alistair Anthony is kept alive. And I hope that the memorial service continues as it has each year for those three brave officers that lost their life.
One bit of the story, which I suspect you haven't mentioned because you won't know much about it, but I do know that there was a passing doctor that when you were pulled out of the sea, and what was nice on this year's memorial, the 40th anniversary, as you say, was that you met up.
We did. I mean, John Franklin, he's been there at each memorial, most years. I was away working in the Channel Islands, although I did come back for some of the memorial service. But every time I was there from the first anniversary, John Franklin was there. So when we were there on the 5th of January this year and John turned up with his good lady, I was overwhelmed, really, to see him.
Now, it wasn't just a doctor, was he? He had a speciality.
He was on one of the cave rescue teams up at Ingleton, I believe, Clapham. His specialism was cold water survival and resuscitation. And he actually, as I understand, lectured in it. And it was one of the reasons why he was in Blackpool that day. He'd been to a conference and he just happened to be passing by, because the ambulance crew, who I knew because we regularly interacted with the ambulance, they said to me subsequently, if it hadn't been for the doctor, we wouldn't have got you back. Because when I was pulled out, I'd stopped breathing, my heart had stopped and I was severely hypothermic. The ambulance crew that were there said it was the doctor that got me back.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah.
So of all them cruel twists of fate that surround that incident, there was one miracle.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
That's right, yeah.
Now, there's a few of us, in fact, there's quite a few of us that believe that yourself and Gordon, Angela and Colin should have been recognised perhaps more than you were for the bravery that you displayed that day. And certainly my own personal view is that you should all have GM after your names, George Medal. Were you recognised, or were you, as collectively, were you recognised for that?
We were collectively incident? With the William Garnett Trophy, which was an award in force for a meritorious act of the year. I did feel slightly embarrassed, to be honest, or more than slightly embarrassed, because I was awarded Queen's Commendation for bravery for my interaction with Colin and the Mountbatten Medal. But I believed it should have been all or none. That's my personal opinion. Everybody, Gordon, Angela, Colin, we all played an equal part. We tried to save a life. We nearly succeeded.
So close.
So close, yet so far. And it should have been all or none.
That incident would have finished off most people. Mentally, certainly, but not you. You're still giving service to the sea, even today.
Yeah, I mean, from my early days, growing up in Fleetwood, having respect for the RLNI and the lifeboat crews, what they did, I would have quite liked to have joined as a crew member when I was 19, 20. But as it was at the time, as a serving police officer, you weren't permitted to join the crew. So obviously, when I retired just prior to the pandemic, the only thing I could do, too old to be a member of the crew, was volunteer in the shop. And once the pandemic was over, that's what I did. I joined the shop volunteers at the RLNI at Blackpool, really to support the brave men and women.
I think you're underselling yourself a little bit, because you don't just volunteer in the shop. There's much more that you do, isn't there?
Certainly the early part of this year was approached. Each station has got a lifeboat operations manager and a number of what the lifeboat call the deputy launching authority. We like at Blackpool to call it the duty launching authority, because you respond to requests for the lifeboats to be launched, and the duty launching authority will make the decision whether the sea and weather conditions are such that the inshore lifeboats that we've got at Blackpool, the D-class and the Atlantic 85, are within limits, and also to determine the request for the launch, whether we can achieve it with the assets that we have, or we need one of the flank stations to support with the all-weather boat, or even the Coast Guard with the helicopter lifting from Carnarvon. So we make the decision to launch, manage the launch and recovery. And while the lifeboats are at sea, the helm is in charge of the crew and the whatever incident they've been deployed to. As you know, and I hope the majority of people in the country know, the RLNI is a charity. It gets no funding. The funding comes from legacies, donations and purchases and fundraising by the many thousands of volunteers that support the operational crews and raise funds for that critical work that they do.
And it's also important to remember the qualities of the people that do work for the Blue Light Services, either as paid police officers, ambulance, fire, or the charities like the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, and the fact that people are willing to sacrifice everything for somebody they don't know.
Exactly. At the end of the day, if there's a life at risk, then the Blue Light Services, the volunteer services like the RLNI, and I stress particularly at Blackpool, every member of the operational team are volunteers. They give up the time, and every time a lifeboat is launched, that crew is potentially risking their life to save an unknown person. So we must always remember that.
Paddy Bram, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again. Because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy course, who, at best, knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who, at worst, if he fails, at least fails whilst daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with these cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat.